convicted were already on the statute books at the time they committed their crimes? Or was it a question of how the laws were actually interpreted and enforced at the time they committed their crimes, and that they were not applied to them? What is law? Is it what is on the books, or what is actually enacted and obeyed in a society? Or is law what must be enacted and obeyed, whether or not it is on the books, if things are to go right? The professor, an old gentleman who had returned from exile but remained an outsider among German legal scholars, participated in these debates with all the force of his scholarship, and yet at the same time with a detachment that no longer relied on pure scholarship to provide the solution to a problem. "Look at the defendants. You won't find a single one who really believes he had the dispensation to murder back then." The seminar began in winter, the trial in spring. It lasted for weeks. The court was in session Mondays through Thursdays, and the professor assigned a group of students to keep a word-for-word record for each day. The seminar was held on Fridays and explored the data gathered during the preceding week. Exploration. Exploring the past. We students in the seminar considered ourselves radical explorers. We tore open the windows and let in the air, the wind that finally whirled away the dust that society had permitted to settle over the horrors of the past. We made sure people could breathe and see, and we placed no reliance on legal scholarship. It was evident to us that there had to be convictions. It was just as evident that conviction of this or that camp guard or enforcer was only the prelude. The generation that had been served by the guards and enforcers, or had done nothing to stop them, or had not banished them from its midst as it could have done after 1945, was in the dock, and we explored it, subjected it to trial by daylight, and condemned it to shame. Our parents had played a variety of roles in the Third Reich. Several among our fathers had been in the war, two or three of them as officers of the Wehrmacht, and one as an officer of the Waffen-SS. Some of them had held positions in the judiciary or local government. Our parents also included teachers and doctors, and one of us had an uncle who had been a high official in the Ministry of the Interior. I am sure that to the extent that we asked and to the extent that they answered us, they had very different stories to tell. My father did not want to talk about himself, but I knew that he had lost his job as lecturer in philosophy for scheduling a lecture on Spinoza, and had got himself and us through the war as an editor for a house that published hiking maps and books. How did I decide that he, too, was under sentence of shame? But I did. We all condemned our parents to shame, even if the only charge we could bring was that after 1945 they had tolerated the perpetrators in their midst. We students in the seminar developed a strong group identity. We were the students of the camps. That's how the other students described us, and how we soon came to call ourselves. What we were doing didn't interest the others. It alienated many of them, literally repelled some. When I think about it now, I think that our eagerness to assimilate the horrors, and our desire to make everyone else aware of them, was in fact repulsive. The more horrible the events about which we read and heard, the more certain we became of our responsibility to enlighten and accuse. Even when the facts took our breath away, we held them up triumphantly. Look at this. I had enrolled in the seminar out of sheer curiosity. It was finally something new, not contracts and not property, torts or criminal law or legal method. I brought to the seminar my arrogant, superior airs. But as the winter went on, I found it harder and harder to withdraw, either from the events we read and heard about or from the zeal that seized the students in the seminar. At first I pretended to myself that I only wanted to participate in the scholarly debate, or its political and moral fervor. But I wanted more. I wanted to share in the general passion. The others may have found me distant and arrogant. For my part, I had the good feeling all that winter that I belonged, and that I was at peace with myself about what I was doing, and the people with whom I was doing it. Chapter 3. The trial was in another town, about an hour's drive away. I had no other reason ever to go there. Another student drove. He had grown up there and knew the place. It was a Thursday. The trial had begun on Monday. The first 3 days of proceedings had been taken up with defense motions to recuse. Our group was the fourth, and so would witness the examination of the defendants at the actual start of proceedings. We drove along Bergstrasse under blossoming fruit trees. We were bubbling over with exhilaration. Finally, we could put all our training into practice. We did not feel like mere spectators or listeners or recorders. Watching and listening and recording were our contributions to the exploration of history. The court was in a turn-of-the-century building, but devoid of the gloomy pomposity so characteristic of court buildings of the time. The room that housed the Assize Court had a row of large windows down the left-hand side, with milky glass that blocked the view of the outdoors but let in a great deal of light. The prosecutors sat in front of the windows, and against the bright spring and summer daylight they were no more than black silhouettes. The court, three judges in black robes and six selected local citizens, was in place at the head of the courtroom, and on the right-hand side was the bench of defendants and their lawyers. There were so many of them that the extra chairs and tables stretched into the middle of the room in front of the public seats. Some of the defendants and their lawyers were sitting with their backs to us. One of them was Hannah. I did not recognize her until she was called, and she stood up and stepped forward. Of course I recognized the name as soon as I heard it, Hannah Schmitz. Then I also recognized the body, the head with the hair gathered in an unfamiliar knot, the neck, the broad back, and the strong arms. She held herself very straight, balanced on both feet. Her arms were relaxed at her sides. She wore a gray dress with short sleeves. I recognized her, but I felt nothing. Nothing at all. Yes, she wished to stand. Yes, she was born on October 21st, 1922, near Hermannstadt, and was now 43 years old. Yes, she had worked at Siemens in Berlin, and had joined the SS in the autumn of 1943.
You enrolled voluntarily?
Yes.
Why?
Hannah did not answer.
Is it true that you joined the SS even though Siemens had offered you a job as a foreman?
Hannah's lawyer was on his feet.
What do you mean by even though? Do you mean to suggest that a woman should prefer to become a foreman at Siemens than join the SS? There are no grounds for making my client's decision the object of such a question.
He sat down. He was the only young defense attorney. The others were old, some of them, as became apparent, old Nazis. Hannah's lawyer avoided both their jargon and their lines of reasoning, but he was too hasty and too zealous in ways that were as damaging to his client as his colleagues' Nazi tirades were to theirs. He did succeed in making the judge look irritated and stop pursuing the question of why Hannah had joined the SS. But the impression remained that she had done it of her own accord and not under pressure. It didn't help her when one of the legal members of the court asked Hannah what kind of work she expected to do for the SS, and she said that the SS was recruiting women at Siemens and other factories for guard duties, and she had applied and was hired. To the judge's questions, Hannah testified in monosyllables that yes, she had served in Auschwitz until early 1944, and then in a small camp near Krakow until the winter of 1944-45. That yes, when the prisoners were moved to the West, she went with them all the way. That she was in Kassel at the end of the war, and since then had lived in one place and another. She had been in my city for 8 years. It was the longest time she had spent in any one place.
Is her frequent change of residence supposed to be grounds for viewing her as a flight risk?
The lawyer was openly sarcastic.
My client registered with the police each time she arrived at a new address and each time she left. There is no reason to assume she would run away, and there is nothing for her to hide. Did the judge feel it impossible to release my client on her own recognizance because of the gravity of the charges and the risk of public agitation? That, members of the court, is a Nazi rationale for custody. It was introduced by the Nazis and abolished after the Nazis. It no longer exists.
The lawyer's malicious emphasis underlined the irony in this truth. I was jolted. I realized that I had assumed it was both natural and right that Hannah should be in custody. Not because of the charges, the gravity of the allegations, or the force of the evidence, of which I had no real knowledge yet, but because in a cell she was out of my world, out of my life. I wanted her far away from me. So unattainable that she could continue as the mere memory she had become and remained all these years. If the lawyer was successful, I would have to prepare myself to meet her again, and I would have to work out how I wanted to do that, and how it should be. And I could see no reason why he should fail. If Hannah had not tried to escape the law so far, why should she try now? And what evidence could she suppress? There were no other legal reasons at that time to hold someone in custody. The judge seemed irritated again, and I began to realize that this was his particular trick. Whenever he found a statement either obstructionist or annoying, he took off his glasses, stared at the speaker with a blank, short-sighted gaze, frowned, and either ignored the statement altogether, or began with, "So you mean," or, "So what you're trying to say is," and then repeated what had been said in a way as to leave no doubt that he had no desire to deal with it, and that trying to compel him to do so would be pointless. "So you're saying that the arresting judge misinterpreted the fact that the defendant ignored all letters and summonses and did not present herself either to the police or the prosecutor or the judge? You wish to make a motion to lift the order of detention?" The lawyer made the motion, and the court denied it. Chapter 4. I did not miss a single day of the trial. The other students were surprised. The professor was pleased that one of us was making sure that the next group learned what the last one had heard and seen. Only once did Hannah look at the spectators, and over at me. Usually she was brought in by a guard and took her place, and then kept her eyes fixed on the bench throughout the day's proceedings. It appeared arrogant, as did the fact that she didn't talk to the other defendants, and almost never with her lawyer, either. However, as the trial went on, the other defendants talked less among themselves, too. When there were breaks in the proceedings, they stood with relatives and friends, and in the mornings they waved and called hello to them when they saw them in the public benches. During the breaks, Hannah remained in her seat. So I watched her from behind. I saw her head, her neck, her shoulders. I decoded her head, her neck, her shoulders. When she was being discussed, she held her head very erect. When she felt she was being unjustly treated, slandered, or attacked, and she was struggling to respond, she rolled her shoulders forward, and her neck swelled, showing the play of muscles. The objections were regularly overruled, and her shoulders regularly sank. She never shrugged, and she never shook her head. She was too keyed up to allow herself anything as casual as a shrug or a shake of the head. Nor did she allow herself to hold her head at an angle, or to let it fall, or to lean her chin on her hand. She sat as if frozen. It must have hurt to sit that way. Sometimes strands of hair slipped out of the tight knot, began to curl, lay on the back of her neck, and moved gently against it in the draft. Sometimes Hannah wore a dress with a neckline low enough to reveal the birthmark high on her left shoulder. Then I remembered how I had blown the hair away from that neck, and how I had kissed that birthmark and that neck. But the memory was like a retrieved file. I felt nothing. During the weeks of the trial, I felt nothing. My feelings were numbed. Sometimes I poked at them, and imagined Hannah doing what she was accused of doing as clearly as I could, and also doing what the hair on her neck and the birthmark on her shoulder recalled to my mind. It was like a hand pinching an arm numbed by an injection. The arm doesn't register that it is being pinched by the hand. The hand registers that it is pinching the arm, and at first the mind cannot tell the two of them apart. But a moment later it distinguishes them quite clearly. Perhaps the hand has pinched so hard that the flesh stays white for a while. Then the blood flows back, and the spot regains its color. But that does not bring back sensation. Who had given me the injection? Had I done it myself, because I couldn't manage without anesthesia? The anesthetic functioned not only in the courtroom, and not only to allow me to see Hannah as if it was someone else who had loved and desired her, someone I knew well but who wasn't me. In every part of my life, too, I stood outside myself and watched. I saw myself functioning at the university, with my parents and brother and sister and my friends, but inwardly I felt no involvement. After a time, I thought I could detect a similar numbness in other people. Not in the lawyers who carried on throughout the trial with the same rhetorical, legalistic pugnacity, jabbing pedantry, or loud, calculated truculence, depending on their personalities and their political standpoint. Admittedly, the trial proceedings exhausted them. In the evenings they were tired and got more shrill. But overnight they recharged or reinflated themselves, and droned and hissed away the next morning just as they had 24 hours before. The prosecutors made an effort to keep up and display the same level of attack day after day, but they didn't succeed, at first because the facts and their outcome, as laid out at the trial, horrified them so much, and later because the numbness began to take hold. The effect was strongest on the judges and the lay members of the court. During the first weeks of the trial, they took in the horrors, sometimes recounted in tears, sometimes in choking voices, sometimes in agitated or broken sentences, with visible shock or obvious efforts at self-control. Later, their faces returned to normal. They could smile and whisper to one another, or even show traces of impatience when a witness lost the thread while testifying. When going to Israel to question a witness was discussed, they started getting the travel bug. The other students kept being horrified all over again. They only came to the trial once a week, and each time the same thing happened, the intrusion of horror into daily life. I, who was in court every day, observed their reactions with detachment. It was like being a prisoner in the death camps who survives month after month and becomes accustomed to the life, while he registers with an objective eye the horror of the new arrivals, registers it with the same numbness that he brings to the murders and deaths themselves. All survivor literature talks about this numbness, in which life's functions are reduced to a minimum, behavior becomes completely selfish and indifferent to others, and gassing and burning are everyday occurrences. In the rare accounts by perpetrators, too, the gas chambers and ovens became ordinary scenery, the perpetrators reduced to their few functions and exhibiting a mental paralysis and indifference, a dullness that makes them seem drugged or drunk. The defendants seemed to me to be trapped still and forever in this drugged state, in a sense petrified in it. Even then, when I was preoccupied by this general numbness, and by the fact that it had taken hold not only of the perpetrators and victims, but of all of us, judges and lay members of the court, prosecutors and recorders, who had to deal with these events now, when I likened perpetrators, victims, the dead, the living, survivors, and their descendants to each other, I didn't feel good about it, and I still don't. Can one see them all as linked in this way? When I began to make such comparisons in discussions, I always emphasized that the linkage was not meant to relativize the difference between being forced into the world of the death camps and entering it voluntarily, between enduring suffering and imposing it on others, and that this difference was of the greatest, most critical importance. But I met with shock and indignation when I said this not in reaction to the others' objections, but before they had even the chance to demur. At the same time I asked myself, as I had already begun to ask myself back then, what should our second generation have done? What should it do with the knowledge of the horrors of the extermination of the Jews? We should not believe we can comprehend the incomprehensible. We may not compare the incomparable. We may not inquire, because to inquire is to make the horrors an object of discussion, even if the horrors themselves are not questioned, instead of accepting them as something in the face of which we can only fall silent in revulsion, shame, and guilt. Should we only fall silent in revulsion, shame, and guilt? To what purpose? It was not that I had lost my eagerness to explore and cast light on things which had filled the seminar once the trial got under way, but that some few would be convicted and punished while we of the second generation were silenced by revulsion, shame, and guilt. Was that all there was to it now? Chapter 5. In the second week, the indictment was read out. It took a day and a half to read. A day and a half in the subjunctive. The first defendant is alleged to have, furthermore she is alleged, in addition she is alleged. Thus she comes under the necessary conditions of paragraph so-and-so. Furthermore, she is alleged to have committed this and that act. She is alleged to have acted illegally and culpably. Hannah was the fourth defendant. The five accused women had been guards in a small camp near Krakow, a satellite camp for Auschwitz. They had been transferred there from Auschwitz in early 1944 to replace guards killed or injured in an explosion in the factory where the women in the camp worked. One count of the indictment involved their conduct at Auschwitz, but that was of minor significance compared with the other charges. I no longer remember it. Was it because it didn't involve Hannah, but the other women? Was it of minor importance in relation to the other counts, or minor, period? Did it simply seem inexcusable to have someone available for trial who had been in Auschwitz and not charge them about their conduct in Auschwitz? Of course, the five defendants had not been in charge of the camp. There was a commandant, plus special troops, and other female guards. Most of the troops and guards had not survived the bombing raid that put an end one night to the prisoners' westward march. Some fled the same night and vanished as surely as the commandant, who had made himself scarce as soon as the column of prisoners set off on the forced march to the west. None of the prisoners should, by rights, have survived the night of the bombing. But two did survive, a mother and her daughter, and the daughter had written a book about the camp and the march west, and published it in America. The police and prosecutors had tracked down not only the five defendants, but several witnesses who had lived in the village, which had taken the bombing hits that ended the death march. The most important witnesses were the daughter, who had come to Germany, and the mother, who had remained in Israel. To depose the mother, the court, prosecutors, and defense lawyers were going to go to Israel, the only part of the trial I did not attend. One main charge concerned selections in the camp. Each month around 60 new women were sent out from Auschwitz, and the same number were sent back, minus those who had died in the meantime. It was clear to everyone that the women would be killed in Auschwitz. It was those who could no longer perform useful work in the factory who were sent back. The factory made munitions. The actual work was not difficult, but the women hardly ever got to do the actual work, because they had to do raw construction to repair the devastating damage caused by the explosion early in the year. The other main charge involved the night of the bombing that ended everything. The troops and guards had locked the prisoners, several hundred women, in a church in a village that had been abandoned by most of its inhabitants. Only a few bombs fell, possibly intended for the nearby railroad or a factory, or maybe simply released because they were left over from a raid on a larger town. One of them hit the priest's house in which the troops and guards were sleeping. Another landed on the church steeple. First the steeple burned, then the roof, then the blazing rafters collapsed into the nave, and the pews caught fire. The heavy doors were unbudgeable. The defendants could have unlocked them. They did not, and the women locked in the church burned to death. Chapter 6. The trial could not have gone any worse for Hannah. She had already made a bad impression on the court during the preliminary questioning. After the indictment had been read out, she spoke up to say that something was incorrect. The presiding judge rebuked her irritably, telling her that she had had plenty of time before the trial to study the charges and register objections. Now the trial was in progress, and the evidence would show what was correct and incorrect. When the presiding judge proposed at the beginning of the actual testimony that the German version of the daughter's book not be read into the record, as it had been prepared for publication by a German publisher and the manuscript made available to all participants in the trial, Hannah had to be argued into it by her lawyer under the exasperated eyes of the judge. She did not willingly agree. She also did not want to acknowledge that she had admitted, in an earlier deposition, to having had the key to the church. She had not had the key. No one had had the key. There had not been any one key to the church, but several keys to several different doors, and they had all been left outside, in the locks. But the court record of her examination by the judge, approved and signed by her, read differently, and the fact that she asked why they were trying to hang something on her did not make matters any better. She didn't ask loudly or arrogantly, but with determination, and I think, in visible and audible confusion and helplessness, and the fact that she spoke of others trying to hang something on her did not mean she was claiming any miscarriage of justice by the court. But the presiding judge interpreted it that way and responded sharply. Hannah's lawyer leapt to his feet and let loose, over-eagerly. He was asked whether he was agreeing with his client's accusations, and sat down again. Hannah wanted to do the right thing. When she thought she was being done an injustice, she contradicted it, and when something was rightly claimed or alleged, she acknowledged it. She contradicted vigorously and admitted willingly, as though her admissions gave her the right to her contradictions, or as though, along with her contradictions, she took on a responsibility to admit what she could not deny. But she did not notice that her insistence annoyed the presiding judge. She had no sense of context, of the rules of the game, of the formulas by which her statements and those of the others were toted up into guilt and innocence, conviction and acquittal. To compensate for her defective grasp of the situation, her lawyer would have had to have more experience and self-confidence, or simply to have been better. But Hannah should not have made things so hard for him. She was obviously withholding her trust from him, but had not chosen another lawyer she trusted more. Her lawyer was a public defender appointed by the court. Sometimes Hannah achieved her own kind of success. I remember her examination on the selections in the camp. The other defendants denied ever having had anything to do with them. Hannah admitted so readily that she had participated, not alone but just like the others and along with them, that the judge felt he had to probe further. What happened at these selections? Hannah described how the guards had agreed among themselves to tally the same number of prisoners from their 6 equal areas of responsibility, 10 each and 60 in all, but that the figures could fluctuate when the number of sick was low in one person's area of responsibility and high in another's, and that all the guards on duty had decided together who was to be sent back. None of you held back? You all acted together? Yes. Did you not know that you were sending the prisoners to their death? Yes, but the new ones came, and the old ones had to make room for the new ones. So, because you wanted to make room, you said you and you and you have to be sent back to be killed. Hannah didn't understand what the presiding judge was getting at. So what would you have done? Hannah meant it as a serious question. She did not know what she should or could have done differently, and therefore wanted to hear from the judge, who seemed to know everything, what he would have done. Everything was quiet for a moment. It is not the custom at German trials for defendants to question the judge. But now the question had been asked, and everyone was waiting for the judge's answer. He had to answer. He could not ignore the question or brush it away with a reprimand or a dismissive counter-question. It was clear to everyone. It was clear to him, too, and I understood why he had adopted an expression of irritation as his defining feature. It was his mask. Behind it, he could take a little time to find an answer, but not too long. The longer he took, the greater the tension and expectation, and the better his answer had to be. There are matters one simply cannot get drawn into, that one must distance oneself from, if the price is not life and limb. Perhaps this would have been all right if he had said the same thing, but referred directly to Hannah or himself. Talking about what one must and must not do, and what it costs, did not do justice to the seriousness of Hannah's question. She had wanted to know what she should have done in her particular situation, not that there are things that are not done. The judge's answer came across as hapless and pathetic. Everyone felt it. They reacted with sighs of disappointment and stared in amazement at Hannah, who had more or less won the exchange. But she herself was lost in thought. So should I not have signed up at Siemens? It was not a question directed at the judge. She was talking out loud to herself, hesitantly, because she had not yet asked herself that question, and did not know whether it was the right one, or what the answer was. Chapter 7. Just as Hannah's insistent contradictions annoyed the judge, her willingness to admit things annoyed the other defendants. It was damaging for their defense, but also her own. In fact, the evidence itself was favorable to the defendants. The only evidence for the main count of the indictment was the testimony of the mother who had survived, her daughter, and the daughter's book. A competent defense would have been able, without attacking the substance of the mother's and daughter's testimony, to cast reasonable doubt on whether these defendants were the actual ones who had done the selections. Witnesses' testimony on this point was not precise, nor could it be. There had, after all, been a commandant, uniformed men, other female guards, and a whole hierarchy of responsibilities and order with which the prisoners had only been partially confronted, and which, correspondingly, they could only partially understand. The same was true of the second count. Mother and daughter had both been locked inside the church, and could not testify as to what had happened outside. Certainly the defendants could not claim not to have been there. The other witnesses who had been living in the village then had spoken with them and remembered them. But these other witnesses had to be careful to avoid the charge that they themselves could have rescued the prisoners. If the defendants had been the only ones there, could the villagers not have overpowered the few women and unlocked the church doors themselves? Would they not have to fall in line with the defense that the defendants had acted under a power of compulsion that also extended to them, the witnesses, that they had been forced by or acted on the orders of the troops, who had either not yet fled or who, in the reasonable assumption of the guards, had left for a brief interval, perhaps to bring the wounded to the field hospital, and would be returning soon? When the other defendants' lawyers realized that such strategies were being undone by Hannah's voluntary concessions, they switched to another, which used her concessions to incriminate Hannah and exonerate the other defendants. The defense lawyers did this with professional objectivity. The other defendants backed them up with impassioned interjections. "You stated that you knew you were sending the prisoners to their deaths. That was only true of you, wasn't it? You cannot know what your colleagues knew. Perhaps you can guess at it, but in the final analysis you cannot judge, is that not so?" Hannah was asked by one of the other defendants' lawyers. "But we all knew." "Saying we all, is easier than saying I alone, isn't it? Isn't it true that you and only you had special prisoners in the camp, young girls, first one for a period, and then another?" Hannah hesitated. I don't think I was the only one who—" "You dirty liar! Your favorites! All that was just you, no one else!" Another of the accused, a coarse woman, not unlike a fat, broody hen, but with a spiteful tongue, was visibly worked up. "Is it possible that when you say knew, the most you can actually do is assume, and that when you say believe, you are actually just making things up?" The lawyer shook his head, as if disturbed by her acknowledgment of this. "And is it also true that once you were tired of your special prisoners, they all went back to Auschwitz with the next transport?" Hannah did not answer. "That was your special, your personal selection, wasn't it? You don't want to remember, you want to hide behind something that everyone did, but—" "Oh, God!" The daughter, who had taken a seat in the public benches after being examined, covered her face with her hands. "How could I have forgotten?" The presiding judge asked if she wished to add anything to her testimony. She did not wait to be called to the front. She stood up and spoke from her seat among the spectators. "Yes, she had favorites, always one of the young ones who was weak and delicate, and she took them under her wing and made sure that they didn't have to work, got them better barrack space and took care of them and fed them better, and in the evenings she had them brought to her. And the girls were never allowed to say what she did with them in the evening, and we assumed she was—" "Also because they all ended up on the transports, as if she had had her fun with them and then had got bored. But it wasn't like that at all, and one day one of them finally talked, and we learned that the girls read aloud to her, evening after evening after evening. That was better than if they— and better than working themselves to death on the building site. I must have thought it was better, I couldn't have forgotten it. But was it better?" She sat down. Hannah turned around and looked at me. Her eyes found me at once, and I realized that she had known the whole time I was there. She just looked at me. Her face didn't ask for anything, beg for anything, assure me of anything, or promise anything. It simply presented itself. I saw how tense and exhausted she was. She had circles under her eyes, and on each cheek a line that ran from top to bottom that I'd never seen before, that weren't yet deep, but already marked her like scars. When I turned red under her gaze, she turned away and back to the judge's bench. The presiding judge asked the lawyer who had cross-examined Hannah if he had any further questions for the defendant. He also asked Hannah's lawyer. Ask her, I thought. Ask her if she chose the weak and delicate girls because they could never have stood up to the work on the building site anyway, because they would have been sent on the next transport to Auschwitz in any case, and because she wanted to make that final month bearable. Say it, Hannah. Say you wanted to make their last month bearable, that that was the reason for choosing the delicate and the weak, that there was no other reason, and could not be. But the lawyer did not ask Hannah, and she did not speak of her own accord. Chapter 8. The German version of the book that the daughter had written about her time in the camps did not appear until after the trial. During the trial, the manuscript was available, but to those directly involved. I had to read the book in English, an unfamiliar and laborious exercise at the time, and as always, the alien language, unmastered and struggled over, created a strange concatenation of distance and immediacy. I worked through the book with particular thoroughness, and yet did not make it my own. It remained as alien as the language itself. Years later, I reread it and discovered that it is the book that creates distance. It does not invite one to identify with it, and makes no one sympathetic, neither the mother nor the daughter, nor those who shared their fate in various camps, and finally in Auschwitz and the satellite camp near Krakow. It never gives the barracks leaders, the female guards, or the uniformed security force clear enough faces or shapes for the reader to be able to relate to them, to judge their acts for better or worse. It exudes the very numbness I have tried to describe before. But even in her numbness, the daughter did not lose the ability to observe and analyze, and she had not allowed herself to be corrupted either by self-pity or by the self-confidence she had obviously drawn from the fact that she had survived and not only come through the years in the camps, but given literary form to them. She writes about herself and her pubescent, precocious, and, when necessary, cunning behavior with the same sobriety she uses to describe everything else. Hanna is neither named in the book, nor is she recognizable or identifiable in any way. Sometimes I thought I recognized her in one of the guards, who was described as young, pretty, and conscientiously unscrupulous in the fulfillment of her duties, but I wasn't sure. When I considered the other defendants, only Hanna could be the guard described. But there had been other guards. In one camp, the daughter had known a guard who was called Mare, also young, beautiful, and diligent, but cruel and uncontrolled. The guard in the camp reminded her of that one. Had others drawn the same comparison? Did Hanna know about it? Did she remember it? Was that why she was upset when I compared her to a horse? The camp near Krakow was the last stop for mother and daughter after Auschwitz. It was a step forward. The work was hard, but easier. The food was better. And it was better to sleep 6 women to a room than 100 to a barracks. And it was warmer. The women could forage for wood on the way from the factory to the camp and bring it back with them. There was the fear of selections, but it wasn't as bad as at Auschwitz. 60 women were sent back each month, 60 out of around 1,200. That meant each prisoner had a life expectancy of 20 months, even if she only possessed average strength, and there was always the hope of being stronger than the average. Moreover, there was also the hope that the war would be over in less than 20 months. The misery began when the camp was closed and the prisoners set off towards the west. It was winter, it was snowing, and the clothing in which the women had frozen in the factory and just managed to hold out in the camp was completely inadequate, but not as inadequate as what was on their feet, often rags and sheets of newspaper tied so as to stay on when they stood or walked around, but impossible to make withstand long marches in snow and ice. And the women did not just march, they were driven, and forced to run. "Death march?" asks the daughter in the book, and answers, "No, death trot, death gallop." Many collapsed along the way. Others never got to their feet again after nights spent in barns or leaning against a wall. After a week, almost half the women were dead. The church made a better shelter than the barns and walls the women had had before. When they had passed abandoned farms and stayed overnight, the uniformed security force and the female guards had taken the living quarters for themselves. Here, in the almost deserted village, they could commandeer the priest's house and still leave the prisoners something more than a barn or a wall. That they did it, and that the prisoners even got something warm to eat in the village, seemed to promise an end to the misery. The women went to sleep. Shortly afterwards, the bombs fell. As long as the steeple was the only thing burning, the fire could be heard in the church, but not seen. When the tip of the steeple collapsed and crashed down onto the rafters, it took several minutes for the glow of the fire to become visible. By then the flames were already licking downwards and setting clothes alight. Collapsing burning beams set fire to the pews and pulpit, and soon the whole roof crashed into the nave and started a general conflagration. The daughter thinks the women could have saved themselves if they had immediately gotten together to break down one of the doors. But by the time they realized what had happened, and was going to happen, and that no one was coming to open the doors, it was too late. It was completely dark when the sound of the falling bombs woke them. For a while they heard nothing but an eerie, frightening noise in the steeple, and kept absolutely quiet, so as to hear the noise better and figure out what it was. That it was the crackling and snapping of a fire, that it was the glow of flames that flared up now and again behind the windows, that the crash above their heads signaled the spreading of the fire from the steeple to the roof. All this the women realized only once the rafters began to burn. They realized, they screamed in horror, screamed for help, threw themselves at the doors, shook them, beat at them, screamed. When the burning roof crashed into the nave, the shell of the walls acted like a chimney. Most of the women did not suffocate, but burned to death in the brilliant roar of the flames. In the end, the fire even burned its glowing way through the iron-clad church doors. But that was hours later. Mother and daughter survived because the mother did the right thing for the wrong reasons. When the women began to panic, she couldn't bear to be among them any more. She fled to the gallery. She didn't care that she was closer to the flames. She just wanted to be alone, away from the screaming, thrashing, burning women. The gallery was narrow, so narrow that it was barely touched by the burning beams. Mother and daughter stood pressed against the wall and saw and heard the raging of the fire. Next day they didn't dare come down and out of the church. In the darkness of the following night, they were afraid of not finding the stairs and the way out. When they left the church in the dawn of the day after that, they met some of the villagers who gaped at them in silent astonishment, but gave them clothing and food, and let them walk on. Chapter 9. Why did you not unlock the doors? The presiding judge put the question to one defendant after another. One after the other, they gave the same answer. They couldn't unlock the doors. Why? They had been wounded when the bombs hit the priest's house, or they had been in shock as a result of the bombardment, or they had been busy after the bombs hit with the wounded guard contingent, pulling them out of the rubble, bandaging them, taking care of them. They had not thought about the church, had not seen the fire in the church, had not heard the screams from the church. The judge made the same statement to one defendant after another. The record indicated otherwise. This was deliberately phrased with caution. To say that the record found in the SS archives said otherwise would be wrong, but it was true that it suggested something different. It listed the names of those who had been killed in the priest's house, and those who had been wounded, those who had brought the wounded to a field hospital in a truck, and those who had accompanied the truck in a jeep. It indicated that the women guards had stayed behind to wait out the end of the fires, to prevent any of them from spreading, and to prevent any attempts to escape under the cover of the flames. It referred to the death of the prisoners. The fact that the names of the defendants appeared nowhere in the report suggested that the defendants were among the female guards who had remained behind. That these guards had remained behind to prevent attempts at escape indicated that the affair didn't end with the rescue of the wounded from the priest's house and the departure of the transport to the field hospital. The guards who remained behind, the report indicated, had allowed the fire to rage in the church and had kept the church doors locked. Among the guards who remained behind, the report indicated, were the defendants. "No," said one defendant after the other, "that is not the way it was. The report was wrong." That much was evident from the fact that it mentioned the obligation of the guards to prevent the fires from spreading. How could they have carried out that responsibility? It was ridiculous, as was the other responsibility of preventing attempted escapes under the cover of the fires. Attempted escapes? By the time they no longer had to worry about their own people and could worry about the others, the prisoners, there was no one left to escape. No, the report completely ignored what they had done and achieved and suffered that night. How could such a false report have been filed? They didn't know. Until it was the turn of the plump and vicious defendant. She knew.
"Ask that one there."
She pointed at Hannah.
"She wrote the report. She's the guilty one. She did it all, and she wanted to use the report to cover it up and drag us into it."
The judge asked Hannah, but it was his last question. His first was, "Why did you not unlock the doors?"
We had—"
Hannah was groping for the answer.
We didn't have any alternative.
You had no alternative?
Some of us were dead, and the others had left. They said they were taking the wounded to the field hospital and would come back, but they knew they weren't coming back, and so did we. Perhaps they didn't even go to the hospital. The wounded were not that badly hurt. We would have gone with them, but they said they needed the room for the wounded, and anyway, they weren't keen to have so many women along. I don't know where they went.
What did you do?
We didn't know what to do. It all happened so fast, with the priest's house burning and the church spire, and the men in the cart were there 1 minute and gone the next, and suddenly we were alone with the women in the church. They left behind some weapons, but we didn't know how to use them, and even if we had, what good would it have done, since we were only a handful of women? How could we have guarded all those women? A line like that is very long, even if you keep it as tight together as possible, and to guard such a long column you need far more people than we had. Hannah paused. Then the screaming began, and got worse and worse. If we had opened the doors and they had all come rushing out...
The judge waited a moment. Were you afraid? Were you afraid the prisoners would overpower you?
That they would... No, but how could we have restored order? There would have been chaos, and we had no way to handle that. And if they'd tried to escape...
Once again the judge waited, but Hannah didn't finish the sentence. Were you afraid that if they escaped you would be arrested, convicted, shot?
We couldn't just let them escape. We were responsible for them. I mean, we had guarded them the whole time. In the camp and on the march, that was the point. That we had to guard them and not let them escape. That's why we didn't know what to do. We also had no idea how many of the women would survive the next few days. So many had died already, and the ones who were still alive were so weak.
Hannah realized that what she was saying wasn't doing her case any good. But she couldn't say anything else. She could only try to say what she was saying better, to describe it better, and explain it. But the more she said, the worse it looked for her. Because she was at her wit's end, she turned to the judge again.
"What would you have done?"
But this time she knew she would get no answer. She wasn't expecting one. Nobody was. The judge shook his head silently. Not that it was impossible to imagine the confusion and helplessness Hannah described. The night, the cold, the snow, the fire, the screaming of the women in the church, the sudden departure of the people who had commanded and escorted the female guards. How could the situation have been easy? But could an acknowledgment that the situation had been hard be any mitigation for what the defendants had done or not done? As if it had been a car accident on a lonely road on a cold winter night, with injuries and totaled vehicles, and no one knowing what to do? Or as if it had been a conflict between two equally compelling duties that required action? That is how one could imagine what Hannah was describing, but nobody was willing to look at it in such terms.
Did you write the report?
We all discussed what we should write. We didn't want to hang any of the blame on the ones who had left, but we didn't want to attract charges that we had done anything wrong either.
So you're saying you talked it through together?
Who wrote it?
You, the other defendant pointed at Hannah. No, I didn't write it. Does it matter who did?
A prosecutor suggested that an expert be called to compare the handwriting in the report and the handwriting of the defendant Schmitz.
My handwriting? You want my handwriting?
The judge, the prosecutor, and Hannah's lawyer discussed whether a person's handwriting retains its character over more than 15 years and can be identified. Hannah listened and tried several times to say or ask something, and was becoming increasingly alarmed. Then she said,
"You don't have to call an expert. I admit I wrote the report."
Chapter 10. I have no memory of the Friday seminar meetings. Even when I recall the trial, I cannot remember what topics we selected for scholarly discussion. What did we talk about? What did we want to know? What did the professor teach us? But I remember the Sundays. The days in court gave me a new hunger for the colors and smells of nature.
On Fridays and Saturdays I managed to catch up on what I had missed of my studies during the other days of the week, so that I could complete my course assignments and pass the semester. On Sundays I took off by myself. Heiligenberg, St. Michael's Basilica, the Bismarck Tower, the Philosopher's Path, the banks of the river. I didn't vary my route much from one Sunday to the next. I found there was enough variety in the greens that became richer and richer from week to week, and in the floodplain of the Rhine that was sometimes in a heat haze, sometimes hidden behind curtains of rain, and sometimes overhung by storm clouds, and in the smells of the berries and wildflowers in the woods when the sun blazed down on them, and of earth and last year's rotting leaves when it rained. Anyway, I don't need or seek much variety. Each journey a little further than the last, the next vacation in the new place I discovered during my last vacation and liked. For a while I thought I should be more daring, and made myself go to Ceylon, Egypt, and Brazil, before I went back to making familiar regions more familiar. I see more in them. I have rediscovered the place in the woods where Hannah's secret became clear to me. There is nothing special about it now, nor was there anything special then. No strangely shaped tree or cliff, no unusual view of the city and the plain, nothing that would invite startling associations. In thinking about Hannah going round and round in the same tracks week after week, one thought had split off,